soon other people will join. Hello everybody. And welcome Tiago for the Cafe Club. Tiago is a postdoctoral fellow at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching since a couple of years since 2018. He graduated at Cambridge in 2015 at the Institute of Astronomy. Then he got our first postdoctoral position as a Nova postdoctoral fellow at the Observatory of Leiden in Netherlands. And he joined NPA in 2018. He works in collaboration with Volker Springer, if I remember correctly from your web page, right? So you can figure out that his research interest is around numerical simulations and hydrodynamical simulations for the physics of the galaxies, and especially AGN feedback. And he is interested in gas evolution and impact of active galactic nuclei. So, Tiago, feel free and welcome.
Okay, thanks very much. Also, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Pity it's not in person, but maybe next time. So I'll be telling you about some recent work I've been doing on the origin of these giant Lyman Alpha nebulae that we see around high redshift quasars. We've now detected them out to redshifts above of 6. So that's really the kind of regime my talk will be focusing on. What will be my explanation for these giant nebulae? I've sort of split the talk into these three parts. So these first two, I will have to be very brief so that I can really focus on these Lyman Alpha nebulae. But before I talk about them, I want to tell you a bit about the cosmological sites of these first quasars above redshift 6, according to our theoretical models. I also want to tell you about a very important process which is implemented into these simulations. This is this feedback from quasars. I'll explain what this means and how we model that. And also what are some of the impacts of this process above redshift 6. And then finally, we'll get to the sort of meat of the talk where we discuss these Lyman Alpha nebulae. Okay, so quasars have now been seen out to redshift 7.5. So the most distant one has a redshift of 7.6. And this is a time in the universe where you are about 700 mega years away from the Big Bang, i.e. the age of the universe is less than 5% of its current age. And if you try to estimate the mass of the black holes that power these quasars, you will arrive at masses which are on the order of 10 to the 9 solar masses. And this is a problem, or at least a challenge for galaxy evolution, because you have to explain how galaxies are able to grow supermassive black holes so rapidly when the universe is so young. And to illustrate this puzzle, I put up this plot here from Wang et al., which is one of the papers reporting the discovery of one of these distant quasars. And what these authors have done is to plot the mass of these most distant black holes, or at least the estimates for these masses, here on this plot. And what they did is they measured if these black holes were constantly accreting at the Eddington limit, what would be their mass history when you go back in time. And what you find is that if the black holes are constantly accreting at the Eddington limit, even at redshifts of 20 and above, you already require pretty massive black holes, which can put already some stress on some of the models to explain how these first seed black holes form. Of course, there's a way to overcome this challenge and still have smaller seed black holes, but that would then require your black hole to grow above or faster the Eddington limit for long periods of time. So no matter which of these scenarios is true, whether you have long extended periods of super Eddington accretion, whether you have constant Eddington limit accretion, you really need to understand what are the kinds of galaxies and cosmological sites that would allow that to happen. And this is sort of the problem I looked at a while back in my PhD. And to address this problem, so we have to remember that the number density of these first bright quasars is very low. So it's 1 in about a gigaparsec cubed. So if you want to simulate them in a cosmological environment, you need a huge, gigantic cosmological box, or otherwise you won't find halos which are mass massive enough or likely enough to host one of these breakaway days. So what we did was we took one of the biggest dark matter only simulations available, the Millennium simulation. We've selected different regions of this box to sample different cosmological environments, and then looked at how black hole formation was happening as a function of environment. I'll be a bit more specific about what these simulations have a bit later.
Juan, tu peux lire tranquillement.
But for now, I'll really just focus on the on these main results. So this slide here shows you six regions in the universe of redshift 6 according to these simulations, which are at the average density of universe at that time. So what you're really looking at here is the cosmic web in its very early stages. So you see these filaments which are forming of slightly higher density gas. If you look really closely, you see these black circles. These I put in my simulations to mark the position of the black holes. And what struck about these average regions of the universe of redshift 6 is that these black holes do not really grow. So their mass is about 10 to the 6 so masses, which only 1,000 times larger than the seed black holes we put in the simulations. So we found that all in these average regions of redshift 6, we were not getting rapid black hole growth sufficient to explain these bright quasars. And as I've hinted at already, to get this, you need to go to the most massive halos in the universe, and the regions look completely different. So if I go to the average region, and I show you just again what happens when you look at the off-dense region, everything changes. The gas is denser everywhere, and in particular, you have these much more well-defined filaments, which now cross at the position of these much larger black holes. So in these black holes have masses of 10 to the 9, so masses, which is what we need to explain these bright quasars. So if you look at the halo mass here, 5 × 10^12, this is extremely rare redshift 6. And it's 5 times more massive than the Milky Way, but at 1 giga-year after the Big Bang. And what I really want to emphasize from these results is this prediction, these theoretical models. So these are theoretical models that give you the right black hole masses. And the prediction they make is there should be a lot of cold, dense gas around these quasars. And this is clear because if you don't have this cold, dense gas reservoir around these very massive galaxies, you don't have the gas to grow the black hole. So this gas, you know, has to come from somewhere. And this is the sort of key prediction. So the question of this talk is, can we observationally confirm or rule out this scenario? And I think one of the most exciting ways, which is sort of recent development to really test this prediction, is to look at Lyman alpha emission. So I said, this is cold, dense gas, which is at about 10 to 4 Kelvin, and we expect it to generate Lyman alpha emission through different mechanisms. I'll tell you later on what these are. So could we look for this emission directly and try to sort of constrain these models? And the data I'll be comparing my models against was presented in a paper introducing something called the Requiem survey, which is a systematic search for extended Lyman alpha emission around quasars above redshift of about 6. So 31 of these quasars were sampled, probed with MUSE, and we found 12 Lyman alpha nebulae out of the 31 in the sample. And I just want to give you here a hint of what these nebulae look like. This will be very important for the later part of my talk. So the red circle shows you the position of the quasar, and this black curve gives you the contour corresponding to 10 to the minus 18 in surface brightness units. So what you see here is these extended nebulae, which are detected. Their sizes are of a few arc seconds, which a redshift 6 would be about 20 to 40 kiloparsec. And you see different morphologies. Sometimes the quasar is at the center of the nebula. Sometimes it almost looks like it is located outside of the nebula, so particularly in this case. And of course, sometimes they're more spheroidal, sometimes they're a bit more irregular and elongated. So this is something that we want to see if our simulations can predict. Okay, so this talk will be, in the third part, a direct comparison between this kind of simulations, where we think we understand rapid black hole growth necessary to explain the first quasars and data from this Requiem survey. But before I show you that, I have to discuss a very important ingredient in these simulations, which is this quasar feedback. And before I go into details of the theoretical models for these processes, I will just show you this video, which is showing you exactly the gas evolution in one of these six overdense halos that I've shown you at the beginning. And what you see here is two different colors. Blue shows you gas which is moving towards the quasar host galaxy, and orange-red shows you gas which is moving away from the host galaxy. So what you see here is again, these filaments, this network of cold gas which is feeding the central galaxy and the central core. So it sort of comes in almost on radio orbits and feeds this central galaxy almost continuously. I'll play that again from the beginning. The thing is, when you start powering black hole growth, you will start having very high AGN luminosities. And if a part of the energy which you release by accretion couples to the gas, we'll see how that happens. What happens is that you can heat the gas or you can push the gas so efficiently that you start also driving these outflows. So what you see here is basically a coexistence of dense gas filaments, which fall into the galaxy continuously. And at the same time, this process, which is ejecting gas from the very central region and powering these large-scale outflows, which you see here. And how are these outflows driven? There's lots of different physical models. And this is in the simulations sort of community, this is an art. How do you model that? And there are different approaches. Sometimes these mechanisms are modeled in a very phenomenological way, which does not have a very clear connection to a physical scenario, but it is instead, for example, designed to be very efficient. And then you add a free parameter for the efficiency of the feedback and you tune that with some observation. But my sort of preferred, or at least my interest, is really to understand the physics of this process and where it comes from. So I've been spending a lot of time exploring different physical mechanisms for AGN feedback. And the one I want to discuss here is AGN radiation pressure on dust. And the scenario here is you have a very rapidly star-forming compact galaxy, probably a high redshift. And if you imagine that the ISM is very dusty, it will absorb extremely efficiently the UV and optical radiation coming from a central AGN. So here's a sort of spherical cowl picture. So you have your AGN in the center and you have your dusty ISM in the host galaxy. At least the UV and the optical will be absorbed very efficiently. And what happens when these dust grains absorb the UV and optical photons is that they will also absorb their momentum. So if you do this, you essentially, via radiation pressure, accelerate the gas outward and launch an outflow if your luminosity is sufficiently high. And in this process, there are two sort of limiting scenarios. One of them is called the single scattering regime. And this is what I just described. So the gas is optically thick to incoming UV and optical radiation. But when the dust grains re-emit this energy in the infrared photons just escape. Or in other words, the gas is optically thin to the infrared radiation. So in this limit, all the force comes from radiation pressure from the UV and the optical, and the infrared doesn't do anything. And since each photon can only have one interaction with one dust grain, the maximum force you can get out of this process is L over C, okay, where L is the luminosity of the quasar. Now, L over C, it turns out, this is a finding that comes from other work that I'll not be talking about, is probably not enough in a cosmological simulation for the AGN to launch a powerful outflow. And you have to then wonder, is there a way of making this process even more efficient? And the answer is yes, but it requires probably very extreme kind of gas configurations. So if you imagine that the gas is very, very compact and there's a huge condensity dust condensity, even these reprocessed infrared photons might be absorbed by the dusty gas. And what happens then is that if you start at the UV and optical, you get absorbed, re-emitted infrared. This photon will have to be absorbed and re-emitted multiple times before it escapes. And since each photon now undergoes multiple collisions and the probability for the momentum kick to be radially outwards, you can actually boost the force above L over C by a factor that depends on the infrared optical depth and also on the gas configuration, of course. So one thing is you have a very smooth gas configuration where you absorb all the radiation. The other one is you have a patchy porous ISM configuration where the radiation just leaks out and does not isn't able to kick the gas enough. And for this reason, we really need to do simulations. So okay, so this is how we model the feedback is via AGN radiation on pressure and dust. And we investigate both these single scattering and these multi-scattering regimes. How do we do this? So a lot of the simulations, are at least the sort of state-of-the-art cosmological simulation, is purely hydrodynamical. This means that radiation from stars and AGN is not really followed, at least on the fly when you run the simulation. Sometimes you can do post-processing and sort of study the radiative transfer after the simulation is done, but what you'll miss is the dynamical impact of the radiation on the gas. And since we are looking at radiation pressure on dust from an AGN, it really is important to capture this. So we moved from purely hydrodynamical to fully radiation hydrodynamical simulations, where besides the usual processes in sort of galaxy evolution, so these are cooling, star formation, supernova feedback, we now also follow radiation from stars and AGN. And this radiation can couple to the gas in different ways. So there's photoionization, there's photoheating, and there's also the radiation pressure on dust that I just described, both in the single scattering regime where the infrared does not have any impact, and the multi-scattering regime where the infrared can boost the radiation force above LOVC. Okay, and so this is what I want to show you now is when we switch from this analytical picture where you have a spherical galaxy and photons imparting their momentum onto gas, but when you go to a fully cosmological simulation of one of these rare quasars, a redshift 6, would radiation pressure on dust drive powerful outflows or not? Here is the answer. This plot shows you the speed of any potential outflow in the simulation. And this axis gives you the luminosity, the bolometric luminosity of the quasar. And I would like to ask you to focus first on these blue data points. They give you the results for the simulations where we only include single scattering radiation pressure. In other words, UV and optical radiation pressure, but ignore the effect of infrared radiation. And what you see is that even at very extreme luminosities, I mean, 10 to the 48 x per second is the Eddington luminosity of a 10 to the tensor mass black hole, so 10 times higher than you really should be looking at, we find that we're actually not driving really any outflows. So there is, to be sure, some fast-moving gas, which is why there are data points on this plot, but this is actually tracing gas, which is the sort of tail high velocity, a tail of the gas velocity distribution in the halo due to just gravity. So this is why, if you at the beginning you can double the AGN luminosity and there is no more outflow or no less outflow. But what happens is at some really really high luminosity you start driving these outflows. So this single scattering radiation pressure is driving some outflows, but the luminosity required to do so is extreme and is much higher than the luminosity of observed quasars redshift 6, which is shown with these vertical gray lines. So I think this is not efficient enough. And it's just an illustration of the same point I made at the beginning, that L over C, which is what single scattering radiation pressure gives you, is probably not enough when you go to a cosmological environment. And here is the sort of interesting result. If you run the same simulation, the same halo, look at the same time, but you now allow the UV, the reprocessed infrared radiation to also be absorbed and remitted and exert radiation pressure, you get an outflow at much lower luminosities. So this outflow is shown here on the right, by the way. So again, you see these filaments and the outflow being driven at some point. So this infrared radiation is really boosting the radiation pressure in this cosmological environment. And we can say more than that, it's allowing outflows to be driven by AGN at reasonable AGN luminosities, and with velocities that agree with some of the data that we have for high redshift AGN-driven outflows. And it seems to be saving the model, because if we only had single scattering, we'd probably think this is not a good AGN feedback mechanism, because it operates either at a scale we don't resolve or much, much larger luminosities than we need. But if you include this infrared, this can really affect galaxy evolution at AGN-like and quasar-like luminosities. And these outflows turn out to be, I mean, here they look, you just see a sort of a hot bubble propagating, but you can look into the gas and sort of in more detail, and they're extremely interesting because they seem to be, to look like the ISM essentially. So this plot shows you again, just a picture of the outflow, and it shows on the left a phase diagram plotted in a sort of different way. So you have the temperature on the y-axis and the speed, the radial velocity in the x-axis, and the color gives you the density of the gas. And this panel is the result for a simulation where we ignore quasar feedback and we only have stellar feedback. So you see that there is fast moving gas. Most of it is very low density and very, very hot. So the black colors here correspond to 10 to the minus 2 particles per centimeter cubed, and these temperatures to about 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8. And now I'll show you what happens when we switch on the quasar radiation. So we find that you go from a sort of more or less prominent hot outflow to a much hotter, much faster, and much denser outflow. You start getting a warm outflowing phase. So if you go back here again, you do have some warm gas moving even at 1,000 meters per second without AGN. When you have the AGN, this moves faster and there's much denser gas in the outflow. And what I think is also really interesting is this phase below 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So sometimes these outflows are looked at through molecular lines. So you might be interested in looking at lower temperatures. Without the quasar, there's almost nothing. At least at these speeds that we show here. And with the quasar, we get even the coldest gas moving at 1,000 kilometers per second. These white colors correspond to densities of about 1,000 particles per centimeter cubed. So what you see here is a quasar-driven outflow, which has something like five orders of magnitude or more in gas density and about six, seven, eight orders of magnitude in temperature. And this is why I say that these outflows are like the ISM. They're just a multi-phase medium that which is just moving very, very fast and being expelled out of the galaxy. And what do these outflows do now? So do we make a turn back towards the impact on quasars redshift 6? Well, we see there are these spectacular outflows. So we may suppose that they will sort of really damage the galaxy. And the answer is they do have an effect on the star formation history of this host galaxy, but we're not completely quenching it. As is sometimes expected, that you blow out all the gas and then the star formation rate goes to zero. What happens is different. This is the moment where the AGN radiation starts and the outflow is driven, and you can compare the green curve and the orange curve, which shows the difference of having no quasar in the simulation and quasar radiation pressure. So what you see is that you obviously reduce the star formation rate when you compare to the green curve, which is the no quasar scenario, but you're changing the star formation rate from 1,000 solar masses per year to maybe 100 solar masses per year at best, which is very far away from making this galaxy passive. So even if you have these strong outflows, it is very difficult to completely and rapidly make this galaxy stop forming stars. And the reason for that is that, as you saw in the movie, there are always a lot of gas falling into the galaxy, brought in by these filaments, even if there are outflows. And these things coexist. It's not that there's either inflow or outflow. And to go now close to the Lyman alpha predictions, this shows you the effect of these outflows on the CGM. So this is, again, no quasar, and this is with a quasar. So this is very qualitative, but it's just to show you that even though you're not suppressing the star formation completely, you are driving some gas out into the CGM and you're changing the way it looks. So you see these filaments, these gas clumps, which disappear if your simulation excludes AGN feedback. So now we go into these nebulae, finally. So there are various ways of generating Lyman alpha emission. One of them is you have gas which is photoionized by the quasar or by stars. And when this gas recombines, when the hydrogen recombines, it will release Lyman alpha photons. Okay, so that's mechanism number one. It's actually thought to be, it's one of the most favored mechanisms for Lyman alpha nebulae. There is a challenge associated with it, which is to really explain the surface brightnesses people measure, you need to invoke very, very high ionized gas densities of about 1 to 100 particles per centimeter cubed at huge scales of 10 to 100 kiloparsec. Okay, so maybe that could be just simulation struggle to do this, but simulations have limited resolution, especially in the CGM, so that could be. Another way is that this transition is excited not by photonization, but by collisions between hydrogen atoms and free electrons. So the free electron passes, excites the hydrogen atom and generates some Lyman alpha cooling emission. Again, this mechanism is when compared to recombination, seen as less efficient. The reason for that is that it operates over a very narrow temperature range of a few, you know, 2 to 5 times 10 to the 4 Kelvin, because at very high temperatures, the neutral hydrogen goes away, and at low temperatures, you find that you get this exponential cutoff in the emissivity. And when you do Lyman alpha, you have to really, really do radiative transfer. And the reason for that is the Lyman alpha has a very high absorption cross-section, which means that even when the photon is emitted, if it encounters an H1 region, it will be absorbed and re-emitted again. It's a bit like the infrared scenario I described earlier, with the added complication that now you have not just a random walk in space, but also in frequency. And this is because when these Lyman alpha photons encounter H1 clouds, the frequency, whether they absorbed and the frequency to which they are emitted depends on the velocity of the H1 region and also on its temperature. And so you can start your source with a very narrow Lyman alpha line centered at the line center. And depending on what kind of gas it moves through, you can get double peaked profiles, you can get one-sided profiles, and so on. So you really need to do radiative transfer. And since there is scattering, there is the possibility of the following. This is slightly different from the recombination collision excitation. So we know that quasars have these very broad and bright Lyman alpha lines, which are in the intrinsic spectra. So if scattering was really, really efficient, it's actually possible, or at least we can imagine, that photons scatter all the way from the broad line region where this Lyman alpha is excited to the halo. So you're not looking then at direct emission from gas in the halo, like a recombination would imply, or collision excitation, but you could be looking at reflected light that comes all the way from the broadline region. And this model has been sort of, let's say, argued against in the past, because for this to work, you need the Lyman alpha photons to be in resonance with the gas in the halo, which would require that they do not scatter very much in the central regions of the halo. Because if they scatter very much there, then there'll be lots of frequency shifts, and then the photons just leave and don't do anything. And this is difficult, because in the central regions, you expect a lot of H1. So this model is sort of controversial and in a way, sometimes not even looked at. So I'll be comparing all of these things. I'll show you just some now in the last 3-4 minutes, some pictures of this ongoing analysis to just compare the all these three mechanisms I discussed in these simulations that I've been describing so far with AGN and without AGN feedback. So this is the gas distribution that I've already shown you earlier. So here we see the quasar host galaxy. It's highly disturbed because there was an AGN outflow episode. You see the streams which are falling into the quasar, and you also see some satellites. I'll be using observational jargon, so I'll be talking in arcseconds. One arcsecond is redshift, is about 6 kiloparsec, and I'll be looking at redshift again, redshift 6 and above. So I'll now show you on the same scale what the Lyman alpha nebula that we get looks like. And this is shown here. So yellow corresponds to 10 to the minus 18, black corresponds to 10 to the minus 19 in surface brightness units. The white star is the position of the quasar. So what you can see is we do get these extended Lyman alpha emission. So that's the finding number one. If you integrate this map, you would get a Lyman alpha luminosity that ranges from 10 to the 43, 10 to the 44 arcs per second. Why do I say range? Well, because the Lyman alpha nebula actually looks completely different, and the luminosity you see is very different depending on the viewing angle. So this is the same system and the same nebula, but look at from different lines of sight. So this line of sight, for example, is close to face on, to where the disk of the quasar is face on, and this one is a sort of edge on case. And it's interesting to point out that sometimes that we see also a very strong morphological diversity. So sometimes we see something which is spheroidal and the quasar is centered in the nebula. Sometimes you see something which is more irregular, more elongated, and with the quasar located at the edge, if not outside of the nebula, a bit like in the observations I showed you at the beginning. But what's really, and I would say, I think really the word is crazy, is what I'm going to show now, is the comparison between the observations and the simulations for the surface brightness of these Lyman alpha nebulae. So these simulations were designed to test AGN feedback. They were never designed to do CGM. There was sort of a later idea we came up with when the data came out. So we were very surprised to find the following. So this is the surface brightness, which is observed. This is the median at redshift 6. And this is what we get in the simulations. So these different dashed lines are different lines of sight. So you see sometimes it's much fainter and a much smaller nebula than the median profile. But of course, this is a median observed profile. Sometimes it's brighter. But if you take the average of all these profiles that we measure in the simulations, you get this black line, which just magically passes through the observed profile. And I think so there was I spent a lot of time just panicking that maybe I've done something wrong and this result would go away, but now it's sort of stuck for a few months. So it, basically the theoretical curve just lands on top of the observations. And now what causes it? Actually, it's neither one process nor the other. So probably all these three processes are important. So I'm showing you just first recombination radiation and collisional excitation. So this is the nebula, and this is the contribution to the profile. So if you see, if you only took recombination radiation, you do a good job at getting the profile in the central regions, but a less or poorer job at large radii. Whereas if you took collisional excitation, you would do a pretty bad job in the central regions, but a decent job at large radii. And when you add these together, you get this black curve. So what this tells you is that you probably need both processes, that they sort of contribute to different scales. And if you took each of these processes individually, at least our simulations don't reproduce the observations. And now there's the surprise. Let's forget recombination and collisional excitation, and let's just look at this scattering of the broad line region, Lyman alpha line. So I put in a very broad line, 2000 kilometers a second. And this is what we find. We get a nebula. So this is now ignores recombination and collisional excitation. And you get this shaded region. And I'll explain in a second why shaded, which also agrees pretty well with the observations. You take a shaded region because the exact normalization depends on how much of the bolometric luminosity comes out in Lyman alpha. And I've put in a range of values, which is reasonable. So 1% is on the sort of upper end of what's seen, and then 0.1% is on the fainter end. So it seems that also scattering from broad line region photons would completely explain these nebulae. And here are just some spectra. One point, there's a lot of things you can talk about the spectra. I just want to say that even if your quasar absorption line is very broad and 2000 contours per second, the Lyman alpha line of the nebula at large scales is much narrower. So sometimes people think, if you have, we see the Lyman alpha line in the nebula is much smaller than the quasar quasar emission line, so this cannot be the source. But actually, we see that too, even if that's the source. So this is, for example, the quasar emission line, the intrinsic spectrum, and you should compare that with the green dashed curve, which gives you the emission line profile of the extended nebula. And this is because these very rapid or redshifted or blue-shifted photons just don't really scatter, and they still get absorbed by dust. They actually just disappear. So final thing, why does broad line region scattering work? And the reason is, and now it all ties together, is quasar feedback. So I just want to show you what a nebula looks like if you don't have quasar feedback in your simulation. So that's what we've been showing you. And this is what it looked like if our simulations ignored quasar feedback. We actually have some that do. And the reason is, and the reason why this has not worked in the past but works now, is that quasar feedback destroys the H1 in the central regions of the galaxy. So it allows the Lyman alpha photons of the quasar to escape without really scattering that much. So they'll still be in resonance with the gas in the halo, and they'll still reflect off and be absorbed efficiently by the H1 in the halo, and will still inflate the nebula. So I think this really is a process that works just as well as recombination and collision excitation. So conclusions, I will go very quickly over them. So I showed you the theoretical model was now able to explain very high black hole masses powering redshift 6 quasars, but you really need to look at very rare massive halos. And these massive halos are very special. They are residing in these regions with this very clear reservoir of cold gas. I've also showed you that these quasars and good physical models would predict these quasars to launch outflows. I've shown you that if you have such outflows, you actually get extended Lyman alpha nebulae. But if you don't, you do not get the nebulae. There are various ways to generate the nebulae. So at face value, you'd seem the recombination alone is not enough. The collision excitation alone is not enough, but a combination of the two does a very good job. But alternatively, scattering from the broadline region of Lyman alpha photons to halo scales works just as well, according to these simulations. And sometimes this process alone can completely explain the nebula. And if we take this agreement between observations and theory at face value, I think we can make some interesting conclusions. One of them is that since we see these nebulae, these theoretical models would suggest that AGN feedback already is operating at redshift 6, because our simulations would predict that you would a very different nebula if this process was not included. And also the match between the theoretical models and the observations may also suggest that observations actually support this scenario where quasars are hosted in these very massive and rare halos. And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiago. I really enjoyed your talk. I'd like to start with comments and questions with a question on one of the first slides you showed. Feel for me. You shown a plot of the maximum velocity as a function of a bolometric luminosity. That's it. And I remarked that the data points, if they are data, are quite few indeed. So, what is the observational status? That at best the data point is date back to 5 years ago, 2017. What's the observational status?
Yeah, so this is now sort of evolved a lot. So this paper is from 2018. And at the time, so we decided to compare our theoretical models with outflows driven at high redshift, because we thought it would make sense to look at redshift zero, where a lot of outflows are reported. No. And at high redshift, there were very few. And I think since then, there has been quite a bit of work. So there's various groups. Mm-hmm. So there's a group associated to Nadia Zakamska. There's a group in Chile associated to Herrera Camus, and also in the Genzel group where this plot is being filled. But I'm afraid the velocity one can get very accurate from the simulations, and you depending on what phase you look at, you can basically span the entire range of this. So we need to kind of make closer comparison with the observations, you know, comparing specific lines rather than just speed of, you know, everything.
I see. Thank you. So any question or comment?
Hi, it's Rafael speaking. So I had a general comment, question, which is something that has never been clear to me. So you said that the momentum is transferred to the dust. And how does it go from the dust to the gas?
Yes. So the sort of basic expectation is that since you have this very strong radiation field, that the dust will be partially charged. And through sort of Coulombic interactions, it will be tied to the gas. And I think this is a fair assumption at the kind of densities we look at. Of course, there is a regime in which you may expect these things to be decoupled. That's not something we can resolve with these simulations, and it's still a kind of process people are trying to develop, but should be looked at in the future, because it is possible that there is decoupling between the dust and the gas. But here the assumption is that they are hydrodynamically coupled, and that's because the dust grains are charged.
Okay, thanks.
I have quite a naive question, I think, and it's probably something you said. Can you say again why, how, what's the mechanism with which infrared can couple and generate this this outflow? I didn't quite understand that. I understand that it was something that needs to be simulated, but I missed it.
Yes, it is kind of tricky actually to understand it. So if you see this schematic here, so the idea is that you have this random walk, which is undergone by these infrared photons, and the point is the infrared photons move outwards preferentially, so they diffuse radially outwards, and that's just because there is more volume at larger radii. So when you look at the direction of the momentum kick, if you take an average of many such photons, it will be pointing radially outward as well. So it's kind of like, you know, imagine trapping a lot of billiard balls moving around, you know, in a circle. They'll be colliding a lot of times with the wall and exerting an outward pressure. So in the code, this is actually treated as a kind of pressure term, in fact. So that's how this works, and you know, this works in this spherical case in a very clear way. What's really not so clear is if you go to something which has holes and a complicated geometry, and this is why we then ran the simulation.
Okay. Thanks. I have one more question, if I may.
Sure.
Just at the end, you said that AGN feedback can be a critical element to the success of this model. I'm curious how sensitive you are to the range of allowed AGN feedback models. Are you particularly simulation dependent, and the connection between the two?
Well, I don't know. This is something we really want to do. And we have other feedback mechanisms implemented. I just did not have time to discuss in this talk. So we have also a mechanism where you have a wind coming from the accretion disk and has nothing to do with dust, but this wind collides against the gas and forms a hot bubble. And we want to see what kind of effect that has. Now, I'm sure it is AGN feedback because we did play a lot with other feedback processes. So supernova, we use different models, stellar radiation, and you know, all these conclusions remain. But I can tell you that I do expect the AGN feedback to variation of the model to have an effect. And this I found because we looked at some of simulations where we cranked up artificially the efficiency of the radiative feedback we used. And interestingly, what we found is that if you have a very, very efficient AGN feedback, the nebula can also go away. And that's because you start destroying the AGN.
Yeah, you've pushed out the gas too far effectively. So so it's important to have the balance, right? So that you have a sweet spot of, you know, not too much opacity, but not too little of
it. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I think if this turns out to be the case, and we have to investigate more, it would be, an extremely exciting way to try to constrain these physical mechanisms. But yeah, we have to do the analysis. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Katharina, raise the hand, please, Katharina.
Hello. Very nice talk. Thank you very much. So I have indeed a related question to the AGN feedback. So in one of the slides, you were showing this comparison, what it does with the star formation rate. And in fact, the conclusion was that the star formation rate is indeed reduced, but the galaxy is not plunged. But I guess this is because you are looking at fairly high redshift, right? And as you said, there is a lot of incoming gas, so the galaxy is able to accrete from the cosmic filaments and so on and so forth. So I was wondering whether I guess you run this simulation only around these redshifts. I can imagine it's computationally very costly. But I just wondered, did you try any run or several runs down to lower redshift? And would you expect, because I would expect that it would quench in the end at lower redshift the galaxies. That would be my first question.
Yeah, so we have some simulations where we ran them until redshift 2. It was with a different feedback model that I did not discuss today. And indeed, what we were finding there is the same picture was applying, this sort of, you know, having AGN turn on and destroying the galaxy was never happening, but at late times, the galaxy was naturally sort of its staff formation rate was naturally dropping. And this is because he became sensitive to the cumulative effect of a lot of AGN feedback episodes where you heat up the halo. So 1 gig a year later, it just doesn't cool as efficiently. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, I'm kind of at peace with that. I think you're right. I think if we ran it for longer, it could be that you have this long quenching. What I'm a bit worried about is when people talk about rapid quenching and something on the order of a few hundred meg a year. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't know if it's some environmental effect where maybe you have a galaxy where this can be happening very quickly, but this is something we just haven't seen.
But this could be also the mass dependent statement, right? So I think here you are focusing more on more massive objects because you are interested in this luminous quasars, right? So if I may have a very quick follow-up question, is that whether you tried also to focus on the populations of lower mass galaxies and see what does that do to these objects? Because now, so usually in the standard way, in the cosmological simulation, people would say, okay, at this mass, let's turn on the AGN feedback. But in fact, I have the feeling that recent observations suggest that this AGN feedback or these quasars are living also in the lower mass galaxies, right? They are just not visible, right? So it would be interesting to see what kind of effect it could have on the lower mass objects and maybe to.
Yeah, so these in these zooms, so we designed them in a way, and that's the you probably know the aim of a zoom to look at these very massive halos. So we sort of ignore, let's say we neglected the smaller objects mm-hmm. a bit in this study so far. We have some of them in the zoom region and one can look. I agree. I mean, even in dwarfs, there's now people who find interesting effects of outflows. And I agree that we should start looking at AGN in these other populations too. I haven't done it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Any other comment or question? Well, if not, thank you, Tiago, again, for your seminar.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Very, very enriching seminar. So see you next week. The speaker for next week is still uncertain, so surprise. Thank you, everybody, and take care.